feels a little unbalanced with the side not working. We hope on Tuesday to get that back going again. We've got them coming out Tuesday. I think this lesson this morning hopefully will be convicting and humbling for you as much as it was for me this week. I know that for no other reason than just to be stressed, I've been stressed the last couple of weeks, and I say that not because I'm unique, but because probably everybody in here has felt some stress over the last few weeks, and if you're not, you will. It'll come. Don't worry about that. We have so much going on, and we try to work so hard, and maybe what's true of me is, of course, maybe true of some of you as well, but really we all work in the service to a myth, and that myth is that it all depends on me. We work in service to that myth that it depends on me, or at least the results depend on me. If things go well, then I did what I was supposed to do. If we were successful, it's because we wanted to achieve what we achieved, or maybe it's because God is rewarding us for what we were doing or how we are doing it. But when things don't go well, we tend to beat ourselves up and say it's well because I didn't do a good enough job, or maybe God is punishing me for something I didn't do right or how I did it. Maybe you've all felt like that at some point or another, like the whole world is on your shoulders. That if you stop doing what you're doing for just a minute, if you were just to take a break, the whole world might come apart. We sort of feel like those guys that spin those plates all at the same time, that if we were just to stop for just a second, that everything would come crumbling down. We all feel so often that it depends on us. That's sort of what we work towards. That's in some ways why we work. Even sometimes when things aren't working, all we do is worry about working. Sometimes just like working, if we feel like if we stop worrying, things will come apart. We worry about our kids, about our parents, about our jobs, this, that, or the other thing. And you feel like if you just stop worrying just for a minute and take a breath, that everything might come tumbling down around you. I think it gets to the very heart of what God invited even Israel to. I think this is what the very heart of the Sabbath days is all about. Israel had Sabbath days, not just the weekly Sabbath day. There was that. Every Saturday was a Sabbath day. And on that day, they weren't supposed to work, but just reflect. Don't work. Don't create. God stopped creating on the seventh day. So stop and just reflect on God and rest. But it wasn't just the seventh day. On the seventh year, they weren't to plant or harvest anything on that year. They were just to eat what they had gained from the sixth year and just let the land and the people rest. There was also what they called a Jubilee year, which was the seventh year. Now, if you're keeping track of that, that's every 49 years. There was supposed to be a year of Jubilee, and that's where all the debts were forgiven, prisoners and slaves were released, the land reverted back to the original owners, and there was supposed to be a great rest and Jubilee. Boy, where is that when we need it, right? Part of that, of course, is a blessing. We live in a culture where we take for granted the weekend. You work 5 days and you get two off. You work a few months and then you may be eligible for some vacation time. Well, that's the world we live in. That's normal for us, but that wasn't normal for the ancient world. The only times or the only kinds of people that enjoyed leisure and vacation were royalty or wealthy people. Ordinary people had to work every day. If they wanted to eat, if they wanted some bread for that day, they had to work for it. If you don't work, you don't eat. And so every day, everybody had to work. That's the way it was in the ancient world. But God had these special people that he freed them from slavery, and he gave them a foretaste of the freedom to come in saying that every seventh day you rest. You don't work on that day. And the same way with the years, with the Jubilee and the Sabbath years, you are to just rest. And it wasn't just a blessing, but it was also a test of trust. God was in essence saying, do you trust me? I know it sounds great having a day off, but no work is kind of hard. It's hard to just stop, to spend a day every week where you believe that you're going to have plenty to eat, plenty to drink, clothes to wear, a roof over your head, and you do all that because God is still working while you're not on your behalf, that God is going to take care of you. Then to take a Sabbath year, for instance, if you were a farmer and you said, on this year I'm not going to plant anything at all, and so if you don't plant, you don't harvest. You have to trust that every sixth year God is going to give you plenty to eat that seventh year. Again, God is using the Sabbath to ask, do you trust me? He's saying that he will provide, that he will work on our behalf, that he will give food to eat, clothes to wear, and a roof over your head. God invited his people to work 6 days, but even on those days to trust in him, and then rest on the seventh, trusting in him. It's sort of like the psalmist puts in Psalms 127, where there he writes, unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. No matter what you do, no matter what your job is, it's a myth that it all depends on you. If I can stay awake and I can be a really good watchman and I can watch over everything, then nothing bad will ever happen to my city. But that's a lie, right? You don't know that. You don't know that if you're a really good builder and build a really strong house, that it will never come down. The psalmist says that it's in vain. You can work your fingers all the way down to the bone, and you think if you are really good at what you do, you still won't be successful unless the Lord is on your side. Unless the Lord builds the house, your work is in vain. Unless the Lord watches over your city, all your watching is in vain. It is in vain that you rise up early and go to late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil. That's a pretty good phrase. Have you ever eaten any of the bread of anxious toil? I think I eat it on a pretty regular basis. Eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. So work, yes. Build houses, yes. Watch over cities, yes. But do so trusting God. You know, work 6 days trusting God that it's not really my labors, my planting, my watering, my fertilizing that makes me have food. It's not all of my hard work that makes sure that I have a roof over my head, but it's God who provides for me. That's why working 6 days trusting God and rest one trusting God is what we should do. Whether it's time to work or it's time to rest, we do all of these things trusting God and the one who makes the sun rise and the rain to fall and the plants to grow. What an incredible way to live your life. Where you work, but you work not believing the results belong to you, but you work knowing that the results belong to God, and you rest. You don't just go on vacation, but you rest, trusting that it's God who gives you food, and it's God who puts a roof over your head. And that's what the Sabbath was all about, was trust in God. So with that in mind, let's look at John chapter 5. It says in verse 1, after this there was a feast of the Jews. Now this is going to introduce us to a section. John arranges things kind of topically over the next few weeks. We're going to look at the feast that John introduces us to, because Jesus has some interesting conversations around these feasts that help us understand who Jesus is, and that he is the answer and the fulfillment and the embodiment of all of those things that those feasts stood for. Here the feast goes unnamed, unless it's the feast of the Sabbath itself, but we'll continue here in verse 1. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. There is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool. In Aramaic, it's called Bethesda, which is five-roofed colonnades. Now, for a long time, the people couldn't find these pools. And then guess what? They did find them. And then that erased their doubts on the accuracy of John's gospel. The fine five-roofed colonnades was formed in a rectangle. There was four on each side, And then there was a pool in the middle. There were actually two pools in the middle. One was a higher pool and one was a lower pool. One was sort of a reservoir that the water would drain out into the lower pool. And that's where these porches, where we read there in the scripture, says, in these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. You just kind of picture that, a multitude of blind, lame, and paralyzed, helpless and hopeless people. Picture what that would look like, their lack of hope and how they were feeling then at the end of verse 3, and most of all verse 4. If you have that in your Bible, count yourself maybe lucky. Scholars feel that verses 3 and 4 were added later, so we're going to skip on over to verse 5. Verse 5 says, one man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew he had already been there a long time, he said to him, do you want to be healed? And that sort of sounds like a no-brainer, but listen to the man's response. The man says, the sick man answered him, said, sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. And while I am going, another steps down before me. Now just picture that. Here's a man who can't walk. And so he says, while I am going. So is he trying? Yeah, he's trying to get into the pool every single time that the water is stirred up. And it's probably stirred up, again, because that upper pool is draining down into that lower pool. But the idea was, the myth was that there was healing in this pool for the first person to get placed. Whoever could get in the fastest, and this man believed that myth. Some scholars believe that this may have been a shrine to the Greek god Asclepius, where people went to find healing. Maybe he believed that myth, but he also believed the myth that we all spend time believing in, that it all depends on me. Because I'm not fast enough, or because I'm not strong enough, or I can't get in the water first, I can't get healed. Jesus asks, do you want to be healed? And the man says, of course I do, but I can't get there fast enough to be first. He is a slave to the myths that he believes in. Verse 8 says that Jesus tells him, get up, take your bed, and walk. And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed, and he walked. And then John tells us, now this was the Sabbath. And every time I've read this week, all I could hear is the movie soundtrack to that. And this is the Sabbath, and you would hear, boom, boom, boom. That's where we are. This was the Sabbath. So the Jews said to the man who had been healed, it is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to take up your bed. I wonder, here is a whole multitude of people who have laid around this pool for years, no doubt hungry and desperate and helpless. How often did these Jewish leaders go down there and take care of them? How often did they go down there and feed them and bless them and encourage them? Maybe this was the first time that any of these leaders had ever had a conversation with this man. And it wasn't to encourage him, but it was to tell him to stop it. Don't carry your bed on the Sabbath. But he answered them and said, the man who healed me, the man said to me, take up your bed and walk. Now, where should the emphasis be on that sentence? The man who did what? The man who healed me. Then it seems like the follow-up should be, what do you mean by heal? Like, are you saying you couldn't walk and now you can? Tell us a little bit more about that. How long could you not walk? But that's not what they said. Instead, they asked him, who is this man who said to you, take up your bed and walk? Not who healed you, not who blessed you, but who told you to take up your bed and walk? But one of the problems with this guy is that he doesn't know who healed him, or at least he doesn't see who healed him, because the scripture tells us that the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn as there was a crowd in this place. Afterwards, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, see, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you. That's sort of strange. Last week we talked about in John chapter 4, the woman at the well, and we pointed out that Jesus never emphasized or talked about her sin, but here is a guy, and all we know about him is that he couldn't walk for 38 years, and the first thing Jesus says to him after he heals him is to sin no more. Well, what is this man's sin? Maybe if it was a Greek shrine, maybe that was his sin. Certainly, one way or another, this man believed in myths. He was believing in the myths about the pool. If he could just get in the pool first, he was believing that myth, though, that it all depends on me. And what was the Sabbath again all about? It's all about trust in God. He is the one that heals and feeds and blesses. Trust in God. And this man wasn't. He was lying there for 38 years, and you might say he was lying there and he couldn't do anything, but was he working on the Sabbath? He was working on the Sabbath. He was desperately trying to figure out a way to get himself into that pool. He was eating the bread of anxious toil, that it all depends on me. And Jesus says, listen, all you have to do is stop sinning so that nothing worse will happen to you. I think what was possible is what happens in a lot of our lives. God blesses us. He bails us out of a jam. And we still don't learn our lesson. We still find ourselves trusting in ourselves. And we have to learn to trust God. That's what the Sabbath was all about. John 5 continues that the man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had healed him. And that is why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." Well, does God work on the Sabbath? He does. That's why his people could rest. You can rest because God is working on your behalf. You may not be planting or harvesting, but God is still giving growth. It still rains on the Sabbath. The sun still shines on the Sabbath. Babies are still born on the Sabbath. There's still food to eat on the Sabbath. The whole reason that they could rest on the Sabbath was because God was still working. And Jesus says, you want to know why I'm working on the Sabbath? It's because my Father is working on the Sabbath. And isn't that what the Gospel of John is all about? If you've seen me, if you've seen Jesus, you have seen the Father. He's saying, I'm doing what I'm doing because this is the sort of thing my Father is doing. My Father is working, and that's why I am too. John 5 continues and says, that is why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. John wants us to understand that the Jews wanted to kill Jesus, not because they misunderstood what he was doing or saying, but it's because they understood perfectly what he was doing and what he was saying. Jesus is saying, if you've seen me and you've seen all the sorts of things that I can do, then you know who God is and you know what God is up to. If you love God, you will love Jesus because he is doing what the Word become flesh would do. He is the human being that embodies the Father. He is the one that God sent and appointed to be the exact representation in this world. It wasn't, again, that they misunderstood. It was that they understood all too well. So Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only that he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, the Son does likewise. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing. And greater works than these he will show him, so that you may marvel." And that's exactly what we've been saying now for a while. You want to know what God is like? God is exactly like Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus was showing them who the Father is. And he continues, he says, "For the Father raises the dead and gives them life. So also the Son gives life to whom he will. The Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son, that all may honor the Son just as they honor the Father. Whoever does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him." Everything that Jesus is going to say in this gospel account brings to the surface that the reason people didn't love, honor, or obey him was because they didn't really love, honor, or obey God. Here were a group of Jews that kept the Sabbath, and I mean they kept it. They policed it as hard as they could. You'd better not pick this up, you better not eat that. But were they really, honestly honoring the Sabbath? Again, the Sabbath was all about trusting God, but who were they trusting in? More often than not, themselves. Look at how well I can keep the Sabbath. I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do. It wasn't about trusting God. It was about trusting in their own obedience, trusting in their own power not to do what they shouldn't. It was always that they were trusting in their own righteousness, their own goodness, their own morality. That's why when Jesus shows up and he says, "Trust in me just like you trust God," they couldn't do that because they didn't really trust God. Jesus would say, "Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life. He does not come into judgment, but has passed from death to life. Truly, truly, I say to you, an hour is coming and is now here when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live." When Jesus talks about the resurrection, that's not the emphasis. They knew that there was going to be a resurrection, and that at the end of that time, all of the dead were going to be raised to life, both the wicked and the just. They knew and they understood that. This wasn't Jesus' point. His point is that the Father has given all authority to him to raise the dead, to bless, to give life, and to judge with authority that belongs only to Jesus. And he finishes up here in the lesson, "For as the Father has his life in himself, so he has granted the Son to also have life in himself. He has also given him authority to execute judgment, because he is the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come out. Those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment." You know, I still have a tendency to read that part and think that it all depends on me. If you do good, you live. If you do bad, you die. But that's not Jesus' emphasis. He's saying that I'm the one who has done good to life. I'm the one who will judge the wicked. And so, what's the application? Well, the application is, of course, to trust Jesus. Do good, trusting in Jesus. Work hard, but work hard, trusting in Jesus. Real trusting Jesus is that when your final Sabbath comes, you rest, trusting that it's Jesus' voice that will call you forth. So our moment of truth this morning is, do I work and do I trust in Jesus? Do I work and do I rest trusting in Jesus? It may be this morning that you're not baptized, and that's what you need to have done. It may be this morning that you have been baptized but find yourself needing the prayers of the congregation. We have people in place that will pray for you. As together you'd come, as together we stand and we sing.